Matthew's Gospel, chapter 25, reading from verse 14. And this is the third of three parables that are about Christ's return at the end of time. They were preached in Jerusalem during Holy Week, just a day probably or 2 days before his crucifixion, but he was looking forward to the time when he would return and preparing his disciples for that, or at least for what they should be doing until he came. The three parables are chapter 24 from verse 45 about the wise and the foolish servant. The wise one looked after the master's stuff and the foolish one didn't. The second is 25 verses 1 to 13, the parable of the 10 virgins that we read last Sunday, saying that getting ready was serious stuff and we needed to pay attention to it. And now in verses 14 to 30, the parable of the bags of gold. And there's a theme that emerges from all these. We've looked at them one by one, but there are some things that they all have in common. And I suppose it's a bit like this. If you can imagine being a parent of teenagers and you go away on holiday for a fortnight and leave them in charge of the house while you're gone. Now, maybe you wouldn't be that foolish, but if you did, you can imagine coming back from the airport and have them standing at the door to greet you and welcome you and throw their arms loving you around you and tell you how great it was to have you back again and what's for dinner that night. And they would make it clear that they were pleased to see you. But if you then got into the house and found the sink overflowing with dirty dishes and the bins overflowing with rubbish and the vacuum cleaner clearly untroubled for a fortnight, and then the neighbours began queuing up at the door to complain about all the noise that there had been every night when you were away, then you would realise that although they were pleased to see you back again, they hadn't given you a second thought all the time that you were away. And that's really what Jesus is saying here. It's not about looking forward to the signs of his return so that we can get out the flags to wave and celebrate when we see him. It's about giving him more than a second thought while he is away. The parables are telling us that Christ's return is certain but unexpected. We know he will come, but we don't know when. And when he does, it will be too late to get ready. It's our lives today that matter. Neglecting that will not just be a foolish oversight, but a drastic and lasting mistake. And all the parables have this in common, that the end result for those who fail is much more drastic than anyone expects. The foolish servant is not just sacked, but cut to pieces. The excluded virgins are not just let in late, but kept out personally and permanently from the feast. And as we'll see at the end of this parable, as well as the first one, there is darkness and weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus is driving home the greater than expected seriousness of being ready for his return. Now, of course, some folks will say, don't be silly, Jesus wouldn't do that. He's far too nice. What Jesus is saying here is, because I am nice, I am telling you now exactly what will happen, so that it doesn't happen to you. Last week's parable, the 10 virgins, emphasized the importance of being ready, but left hanging the question of how we get ready. What does Jesus expect? And I promised you then that this week's parable would answer that question. And like all good TV shows, what I'm going to do is string you along and leave you hanging again at the end, because actually it's the next bit from verses 31 to 46 that really answers the question. But nevertheless, this parable we are about to read, I think, takes us in the right direction of what needs to be going on in our lives and in our hearts and our minds if we are to be ready for Christ when he comes. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 25, from verse 14, the parable of the bags of gold. Again, he says, it will be, the kingdom of heaven will be, like a man going on a journey, who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. And then he went on his journey. And the man who had received 5 bags of gold went out at once and put his money to work and gained 5 bags more. So also the one with 2 bags of gold gained 2 more. But the man who had received 1 bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. And the man who had received 5 bags of gold brought out the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 bags of gold. See, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with the 2 bags of gold also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 bags of gold. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. And then the man who had received 1 bag of gold came. Master, he said, I know that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown, gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers, so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. So, take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have, will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Amen. And I pray God's blessing on our time together. When my school, when I was a child, decided they needed to buy a new minibus, the fundraising method that was chosen was to give each pupil a £5 note and challenge us to multiply it. And I remember going out and picking brambles along with the rest of my family on a September picnic and picking apples off the tree in the garden and using my £5 to buy some sugar with so that I could stand and watch my mother turning it into the jam before I sold all the jam back to her. For the same price as she could have bought it in the local supermarket. I was able to tell her that her jam was much better quality, so she was really getting a bargain, and she seemed quite pleased with it. The only other thing I remember from that fundraising project is that this Bible passage was read at the school assembly that Monday morning in order to launch the project. Jesus the Capitalist preaching on investment and blessing economic growth. Well, one thing we can be absolutely sure about is that is not what this passage is saying. The master in the story does represent Jesus. He is the one who is going away and going to return. His servants, one of them, potentially represents each one of us, the people with whom he will one day settle accounts. But when we get to the end of the story and Jesus has come back again, you can see that the bags of gold are still precious. And the one thing that people of all faiths and none agree about is this, that no matter how much money you have, gold or otherwise, the day before you die, you won't have any the day after. So the bags of gold, whatever they are, don't represent money. We cannot prepare for Christ's return by getting rich now. So how do we prepare for his coming? What is the parable teaching us? Well, if you think about anybody who is coming to your house, your preparation for them depends on who they are and why they're coming. So if you've invited friends round for tea, for example, you will prepare some food and set the table. If you've invited a painter to paint the dining room, then you'll move the table out into the hall and all the other furniture as well. If it's your birthday and the postman's coming, you might well stand by the letterbox hoping that there's going to be something nice. If it's a general election campaign and there's candidates on the prowl, you might bar the door and hide behind the curtains. It depends on what we think of the person who is coming. And that's the key difference in this parable here between the first two servants who invest the money and return a profit and the third servant who buries it under their ground. The difference is their attitude to the master. The first two do what the master expects, and so he calls them good and faithful in verse 21 and 23. The third one refuses to cooperate with his master because he thinks his master is a greedy man and hard. So what we need to do is follow the story of this third servant and try to discern what the problem attitude is. So first of all, in verse 18, you can see what he did. He took the money and he dug a hole in the ground and he hid his master's money. Now, to you and me, that seems daft. We would never bury money in a hole in the back garden. It would be even more stupid than putting it in a biscuit tin and hiding it under your mattress. The master's advice in verse 27 to put the money in the bank seems to us just like plain common sense. But we need to understand that's probably not how Matthew's readers understood the story. Bankers did exist in those days. Jesus talks about them in the story, but not as the kind of safe, reliable institutions that you and I are used to, where your savings are backed by a government guarantee. Bankers in those days were more like today's loan sharks, perhaps. Dodgy, unregulated, unreliable, insecure. And actually, Jesus' apparent endorsement of them here, that would have been a better thing to do with your money, is one of the surprises in the parable. And we should always look for the surprises when we read the parables to understand the point that's being made. Hiding your money in a hole in the ground was, in fact, fairly common practice in those days. And probably the safest thing to do with it if you wanted to keep it safe. So what the third servant is being condemned here for is not foolishness, not a lack of common sense, but for being overcautious, for not being risk-taking enough, so that in the master's view, even the dodgy loan sharks, because there was some possibility of profit from them, would have been a better way of looking after the master's money. So why didn't the servant do that? Well, his explanation comes in verse 24. He says to the master, "You are a hard man. You harvest where you did not sow. You gather where you did not scatter seed." In other words, you get other people to do all the hard work for you, while you derive a benefit from them. You exploit people. You rip them off. You take advantage of them. And that's not an uncommon complaint of workers against their bosses. We slave away on the shop floor all day or sweat and grind away down the mine while the bosses sit in the office drinking coffee all day and get an index-linked pension as well as their generous salaries. So what's happening here is either that the master is afraid of his master's hardness. If I take my money or his money and do something dodgy with it and the investment doesn't pay off and I lose the money, then maybe the punishment I face will be terribly severe from such a hard man and I'm too scared to do that. Or else he is making some kind of political protest. He's a kind of early socialist. He's saying to his master defiantly, "I am not going to bust a gut making money for you." Either of these are his explanation. The master for his part, explains it differently. He says simply in verse 26, "You're a wicked and lazy man, deliberately disobedient because you couldn't be bothered doing any work." So we have three possible explanations for the third servant's failure, three attitudes which defined his activity: laziness, or resentment, or fear. And the question we need to ask ourselves is which of these attitudes might make us unready for Christ when he returns. What about fear, for example? We might get it wrong. Well, the fear of the Lord, Proverbs tells us, is the beginning of wisdom. And as we've seen in all these parables, there is something to be afraid of, because Christ in his return is going to do some terrible things to those who are not ready. They're written to highlight that danger. But of course, the irony of the story is that the servant's fear, if that's what's driving him, is what angers his master, because it makes him do nothing. He was so afraid of losing the money that he angered his master by doing nothing with it, when the truth was that he could quite safely have risked almost any loss so long as there was a hope of some return in what he did. So what is at stake here is that attitude which says, I am going to do my best throughout my life to keep well in with God by doing nothing wrong. I'm going to make sure I don't put a foot across the line, and then God will have nothing to blame me for. And if it comes to the day of judgment and God simply passes me by to point the finger at the sinners, then I'll be satisfied that I've got away with it. And the parable is saying that's not what God is looking for. If all God wanted was that people who believed in him never put a foot wrong, then he's got a simple way of making sure that happens. He could simply take us all to heaven now, where there's no possibility of making any mistakes. And what this passage is suggesting is that on that day when Jesus returns, he will have far more to say about things that we haven't done than any of the things that we have. I'm going to play it safe. I'm not going to risk try praying, because there's the possibility of disappointment. God might not, in fact, answer my prayer. I'm certainly not ever going to pray out loud in public, because I'm in danger of muddling my words and embarrassing myself. And I'm never ever going to share my Christian faith with anyone who doesn't yet believe it, because they might ask me questions that I can't answer about evolution or suffering or other faiths, and there's a danger that I'll get the answers wrong. And I'm not going to give my money to that overseas aid charity, because I know that so much is spent on administration and there's always the danger of corruption as well, so it might not reach those who really need it. I'm not going to tell anyone what I think the Bible means, because other people might think they know better. And I'm not going to risk changing things in church, because there's a risk, well, actually there's a certainty that somebody will be offended. I'm going to play it safe. I'm going to keep my head down and make sure God has nothing to blame me for. Did you ever hear of the boss of a Formula One race team who, when he came out to ask his drivers how they'd get on in the race, expecting them perhaps to say, I overtook so many cars, or I finished in such and such a place in the podium, did you ever hear of the boss who was pleased with the driver who said to him, look, I've kept your car beautiful. There's not a mark on it, and the fuel consumption has been absolutely zero, because I've kept it under wraps in the garage while all these other fast cars were racing around those nasty tight corners. Our risk-taking God, think of the way that he entrusted his perfect creation to human beings, or think of the way that his only son was laid as a baby in a manger. Our risk-taking God wants servants like himself who will serve. And the parable says that we are equipped according to our potential and expected to work for the results. So there is a danger of fear. What about resentment? What about that big-headed God we have? The one who expects my total devotion in this life, risking everything, sacrificing everything, for the privilege of being able to spend eternity bowing down before his throne, telling him how great he is. Why should I work for someone with such an overinflated ego? In practice, that is the attitude that lots of us seem to have, because if we think about it, we see that we grudge our Christian service. We look forward to doing other things willingly, and either with regrets or not at all, we give our time to Jesus. But one of the twists in the tale of this parable is what the master says in verse 28. Do you see it there? He says, take the bag of gold from him, the third servant who wasted the opportunity, and give it. We expect him to say, give it back to me. Give me my money back. But he doesn't. Take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. And that's a surprise. The one who started off with 5 and made 5 more isn't left with nothing, but gets to keep the 10. It's his money. And even now, he has, having added to his fortune more than he originally had. And even that's only the beginning, because the master makes it clear that on his return, as a reward for having been so good and faithful, those 10 bags of gold are just a small thing compared with the new and additional responsibilities that are going to be given. And even that's not the end of it, because he also says, not, you are signed up for my business partner for life, sign here in the dotted line. Come on in and share my happiness. Come into the family, come into the house, come in and belong with me. My first ever job, when I think I was about 13 or 14, was watering my neighbor's tomatoes. He had gone away on holiday, I think for 10 days, and I was to go in every day and look after them, and my wages were agreed. I think it was £10 for the week, although looking back that sounds rather a lot. Maybe I'm imagining it. And when he came back, he was very pleased and he gave me my money and we lived happily ever after. But suppose he'd come back and said, well done, the tomatoes are looking great. I'd like you to pick them and have them all, they're yours. And I'd also like you to drive my BMW. And here's the keys to the house. And I wonder if you'd think of marrying my daughter. That's what the returning servant does here. Come on in and share my happiness. Much more than you have earned is what you get to keep. So that all that these first two servants do for their master turns out in practice to have been done for themselves as well. Because Jesus gets nothing out of them that he doesn't also share with them, and multiplies their best results into the bargain. And what produces that response is a difference in attitude that was there right at the start of the story. If you read it carefully, look at verse 16. The man who had received 5 bags of gold went out at once and put his money to work. Verse 18, the man who had received 1 bag went off and hid his master's money, because it's got nothing to do with me. See, the kingdom of God is yours and mine. Just as the church of Jesus Christ is you and me, its success is our prosperity, its growth is our fulfillment. And all our work is done in the service of God, who in turn does his everything for us. And that really deals with the laziness of as well. If you think of all the time that we sometimes spend not only on making money for ourselves, but also on planning our trips and our holidays and decorating and furnishing our homes and pursuing our hobbies and interests and supporting our team to get it to the top of the league, then we see that we really are very rarely lazy people. We simply choose what it is that we're lazy about. We're actually very gifted in dedication and commitment. We can give a lot of time and energy to the things that matter. What we are afraid of is commitment to anyone or anything other than ourselves, because commitment risks exploitation. Just as financial investment with five bags of gold in the hope of doubling your money risks losing some of it. The value of your investments can fall as well as rise. We risk being exploited when you give unconditional love to our husband or our wife, who might take us for granted, or establish a strong emotional attachment to a daughter or a son or even a grandchild who might never say thank you or send that thank you letter at Christmas. Or the employer who uses you and then sacks you when the economic downturn comes. Or the friend who leans on you and then deserts you when a better friend comes along. Commitment always runs the risk of being treated as a doormat, and all of us have the footprints to prove it. It is only safe to love someone else who loves you as much as you love them. Then you can give your all in taking care of them, knowing that their all is being given to taking care of you. Which means that when it comes to doing what God wants, it is the one and only relationship in which there is no need to hold back or to be lazy, given what he has already done and is doing for you. And then once we are within the security of that love, we can even risk serving other people too. Jesus wasn't there. The master wasn't there, but the servants could risk everything in his absence, knowing he was coming. An enormous sum has been given to us to invest, according in verse 15, to our talent or our ability. Actually, the word talent originally simply meant a weight. It was about 30 kilograms or half a hundred weight. So that amount of gold times five for the first service, it's an enormous sum of money. And in actual fact, if you're interested, the word talent has only come in our language to mean abilities or what we can do because of this parable. It was called the parable of the talents, and it has been read as being about our natural abilities. But that is to misunderstand what Jesus is saying here. The point is not that God gives us all different natural abilities, although that is true. The point is that God matches our natural abilities with his opportunities. And the opportunities are vast, and the potential is there to do something magnificent with them, to make them effective for him. Our abilities and God's opportunities combine in the parable in this highly lucrative way, not to yield bags of gold which will be worthless, but to yield things of eternal value. And our task for now, until Christ returns, is to make the most of these, fearing nothing, because he'd rather we tried and got it wrong than didn't try at all. Resenting nothing, because all that we gain is done for us as well as him. And lazy about none of it, because there's simply nothing better that we can do with our lives. Our task, to make the most of them. Our motive is knowing who it is that's coming. And the actual profitable tasks themselves, as I said, I'll tell you about another time in verses 31 to 46. I pray that God will follow with his blessing the reading and the preaching of his word.